This is Still Processing. A lot of you have not been here. A lot of new faces. So what is Still Processing, you might be asking? And it's a good question. And it's one that we are continually thinking about and evolving. But the main thing it is what you're about to experience, which is a monthly conversation with someone with something to say and who's willing to say the things that need to be said, right? About a number of different issues. We are living in unprecedented and strange times. And lots of people are changing their minds about a lot of things. And Christy and Brian know this well because they've been working in this space for as long as I have, longer, really. So we started Still Processing because we wanted a space where we could talk about anything, where people could be honest about anything, where we could learn from each other, where we could find community, where we could find other curious and, frankly, progressive people in Southwest Michigan. Now to Christy, our guest for today. Christy Berghoff is a mom of four and life partner to Brian. And the four, are all four here?
Three of the four.
Three of the four. Excellent. Good work on y'all. Thanks for coming out. We're glad to have you. Bring down the age, the median age, considerably. She's a writer, civil discourse consultant, photographer, musician, gardener, as you'll hear, and global backpacker. She is also a mindfulness practitioner and leads retreats and pilgrimages that focus on contemplation, mindfulness, and spiritual formation. She was raised, and this is important, she was raised barefoot on a 40-acre flower farm in Holland, Michigan. And this is a big part of her story that we're going to discuss today. After graduating from Calvin College with a degree in political science, she moved to D.C., worked for a Republican congressman on Capitol Hill. Don't hold that against her. Yeah. I just kidding.
I've also been on a journey. So.
After growing dissatisfaction with the world of politics, she attended Calvin Theological Seminary. Christy and her husband Brian have been planting churches for over 20 years and are passionate about creating community for people who have been hurt by past church experiences or who have felt unwelcomed by the church for a variety of reasons. I guessed on this date. Is it 2016?
No, it's when? When did we move back?
2014.
Use the mic.
Oh.
There you go. 14.
2014.
Okay, got it. I just kind of guessed. I knew it was around there. In 2014, Brian and Christy moved their family back to Holland, which was a difficult move, which you will hear about, to the 40-acre farm of Christy's childhood, where they currently live and continue to raise their family. And Christy's new book, Rooted, a Spiritual Memoir of Homecoming, is out now. And this is one of the launch events, and we are excited about that. If you didn't get a chance to buy a book or get it signed by Christy, too bad. You're totally out. I'm just kidding. You can do it afterwards. We will make time for you if you want to do that. Christy, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Josh.
All right. Before I start, this one's going to test. Looks like we might be stuck with this problem. Not sure. I want to show you a couple pictures before I delve into something different. What is that in the background, Christy? Is that your home?
That's the shed. We call it the shed.
Okay.
That's my writing shed and Brian's office space.
Okay. So. Excellent. And what are the flowers in front of it? Can you see them well enough?
Yeah, those are larkspur. Those are
and
also
here's
larkspur.
Here's an amazing picture, like incredible, of the farm. And we will come back to that. But we want to do a little something at the beginning on the 4th of July, if you can believe it. And what we want to do quickly-ish is show you some excerpts of a speech by Frederick Douglass. As you can see, and maybe as you know, although I am somewhat saddened and a bit ashamed to admit that I don't know as much about Frederick Douglass as I would like I didn't know about this speech, which is called What to the Slave is the 4th of July. Maybe it was introduced to me. I don't know. I don't remember. But I came across it, And I wanted to play part of it today. So he was a 19th century abolitionist writer, orator, who was born into slavery in Maryland in 1818, escaped to freedom in 1838, and became a leading voice of the abolitionist movement. He was known for powerful speeches, you'll hear some of that today, and autobiographies, which detailed his experiences and advocated for the abolition of slavery. He also supported women's rights and was a firm believer in equality and justice for all. So it will give you an introduction of what you're about to see, which are excerpts from the speech, and it will tell you that these are descendants of Frederick Douglass reading this speech. NPR did this in 2020. So here we go.
Do I look there or yeah. there? Or? Okay. Okay. My name is Alexa Ann Watson, and I am the great-great-great-granddaughter of Frederick Douglass.
Douglass is my great-great-great-great.
I am the great-great-great-granddaughter of Frederick Douglass.
I am the great-great-great-great-grandchild.
I've been counting on my fingers since I was, like, five.
Whenever you're ready, here we go.
This is the 4th of July. It is the birthday of your national independence and of your political freedom.
Fellow citizens, I shall not presume to dwell at length on the associations that cluster about this day. The simple story of it is that 76 years ago, the people of this country were British subjects.
Oppression makes a wise man mad. Your fathers were wise men, and if they did not go mad, they became restive under this treatment.
With brave men, there's always a remedy for oppression.
They succeeded, and today you reap the fruits of their success. The freedom gained is yours. And you, therefore, may properly celebrate this anniversary.
Fellow citizens, pardon me. Allow me to ask, why am I called upon to speak here today? What have I, or those I represent, to do with your national independence?
Are the great principles of political freedom and of natural justice embodied in that Declaration of Independence extended to us?
I am not included within the pale of this glorious anniversary.
Your high independence only reveals the immeasurable distance between us. The blessings in which you this day rejoice are not enjoyed in common.
The rich inheritance of justice, liberty, prosperity, and independence bequeathed by your fathers is shared by you, not by me.
The sunlight that brought life and healing to you has brought stripes and death to me.
This 4th of July is yours, not mine.
You may rejoice, I must mourn.
Fellow citizens, above your national tumultuous joy, I hear the mournful wail of millions.
At a time like this, scorching irony, not convincing argument is needed.
Oh, had I the ability and could reach the nation's ear, I would today pour out a fiery stream of biting ridicule, blasting reproach, withering sarcasm, and stern rebuke.
For it is not light that is needed, but fire.
It is not the gentle shower, but thunder.
We need the storm, the whirlwind, and the earthquake.
The feeling of the nation must be quickened.
The conscience of the nation must be roused.
The propriety of the nation must be startled.
The hypocrisy of the nation must be exposed.
And its crimes against God and man must be proclaimed and denounced.
What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him, more than all other days in the year, the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is the constant victim.
To him, your celebration is a sham.
Your boasted liberty and unholy license.
Your national greatness, swelling vanity.
Your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless.
Your denunciations of tyrants, brass-fronted impudence.
Your shouts of liberty and equality, hollow mockery.
Your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings.
With all your religious parade and solemnity are to him
mere bombast,
fraud,
deception,
impiety,
and hypocrisy. There is not a nation on the earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of these United States at this very hour. Allow me to say in conclusion, notwithstanding the dark picture I have this day presented of the state of the nation, I do not despair of this country.
Those are obviously powerful words for when they were spoken, in many ways more powerful than when they are spoken into this context now. But a lot of that lands in our current context, for me anyways. I did notice that I got something wrong that I think is important to note, and it's what to the slave is your 4th of July, not the 4th of July. And you notice at the beginning, he makes a point of explaining, and even in some ways holding up the founders, but explains that the slaves and he himself don't find themselves in that category, right? What lands for you?
As I'm hearing that, I'm thinking of, you know, recent protests. I'm thinking of the so-called Big Beautiful Bill. I'm thinking of all the upside-down flags that I see. And to me, that's not saying go away, America, or I don't believe in this. To me, that's saying, like, we have some things that we need to right side. You know, rightfully so, I think people are waving their flags, but upside down.
And I think, just one last thing on this, and I want to get to the book, that's the main thing we're here for, is to say that this is also patriotism. Don't forget that. What Frederick Douglass did here is maybe the height of patriotism, okay? To criticize your country, to want it to live up to certain ideals, is patriotism. And there are lots of other people like Frederick Douglass that did this in our history. These are the heroes of our country. Okay, let me try and make a clumsy transition. Tell me what you think of it.
Okay.
All right. As I thought about his speech and your book, I did see an overlap here of alienation in coming back to a place and not feeling welcome, right? In 2014, that was a real concern of yours. You were not happy to be coming. You were not thrilled.
We were not thrilled to be coming back, no.
As you say here, I was terrified. So you say in the first paragraph, you just give for us the basics that you were taught about Christianity and religion, right? Which was pretty closed, I guess I would say, right? And focused on belief. And you say, I was terrified. It was nearly impossible to imagine dragging our exhausted bodies back to the most politically and theologically conservative pocket of the state of Michigan. I recalled the way my community had treated people who didn't see the world like they did, people like the person I had become. I almost couldn't breathe as I thought of the kind of cruelty our family could potentially be subjected to.
Yeah, you know, and I would say, Josh, that the values I was taught here remained. But that was so hard for people to understand when we came back, because I was taught things like the importance of truth, about treating your neighbor with love and kindness, about helping those in need, about welcoming the immigrant. My church did that growing up with Cambodians. And those values never changed. What changed was my understanding and my exposure to systems of injustice, to people who were suffering tremendously in ways that I could never have comprehended growing up here in a very white, middle class, for me, Christian Reformed, everything, all my social circles, everything, Christian schools, it was all Christian Reformed. But none of those values changed. In fact, I would say I carried them with me into the world And because I took those values seriously, my politics shifted. And as the more I read the scriptures, my theology shifted. And so coming back, I knew how I was going to be treated because I, in fact, did treat people that way who were as I had become. And I knew how ugly it could get. I was one of those people that was ugly and awful towards people, you know, who questioned things or who had different views. But I still cling to the values, and I still do to this day, that I was taught growing up.
Excellent. I love this ending. I just want to highlight it. Notwithstanding the dark picture I've this day presented of the state of the nation, I do not despair of this country. I don't know if I could say that right now, if I'm being honest. But I think it's important to try and get to a place of not being in despair for your country, or not being in despair, period. All right, I saw this a long time ago.
Okay.
And then when I read your book, I thought of this, and I happened to find it back. It's really quick.
How do you think that kind and sensitive humans should process all of the violence and hatred that happens in the world?
Oh, I know why you're showing me this.
Okay. These are some beautiful quotes from the book that I just kind of look at real quickly. And then we'll dive in to some of the specifics in the book. So you have the earth knew me. A voice from somewhere whispered to my heart that this patch of earth would love me, accept me, and understand me just exactly as I was in all my circumstances, regardless of how I fared in the world. I walked the trails and lay on the grass, stared at the sky, and let my soul breathe. The land told me I was loved. The trees stood still and whispered that I belonged. The forest held my grief better than any pew. When I cried beneath the canopy of leaves, I felt God closer than I had in years of church going. The world tells us to produce and perform. The earth teaches us to rest and regenerate. Being close to the land wasn't just healing. It was an act of resistance. The world demanded hustle. The earth invited me to rest. Unpack those a little bit for me.
Well, I was first just going to give a little context for this, and that is, and for those who don't know my story, when we moved back here, we moved back to the farm that I grew up on, that my father grew up on, that my grandparents lived on. So it was 40 acres. That's very, very familiar to me, and I would say intimately. I'm on intimate terms with that land. I know all the dips and the bends and, you know, where the moisture gathers after a storm, all of that. And so the earth was kind of this familiar friend to me, the 40 acres, when we moved back. So as nasty as the world was, I knew the earth would always accept and embrace me and restore me. So
let me speak for, like, an earlier version of myself. And probably still a part of who I am right now, which is not someone who grew up with this sort of close relationship to the earth and to nature. I mean, I am old enough to have grown up without, like, cell phones and all that kind of stuff. So I spent a ton of time outdoors, of course. A lot of it was in sports, though, if I'm being honest. So I did, as I was reading, I did remember those rhythms of my younger days as I read. It was a beautiful memory, and I appreciate it. But I can feel in me when I hear these things some sort of rational skeptic comes up inside of me thinking, I like the sound of these sentences. I like the idea of it. But is it real? Mm. Does that make sense? I've moved a long way in that direction. Yeah. And I think it what you've written is so persuasive and excellent and beautiful. But I just kind of wanted to lay that at your feet and see what you think.
Yeah. So I, I kind of talk about this a little bit in the introduction, that I see, for one thing, my privilege in growing up with 40 acres. Now, a lot of people would have looked at us at times when I was a teenager. I would have looked at myself and said, we are not privileged. You know, I grew up in my brother's hand-me-downs. Like, how embarrassing is that? You know, going to the Christian school in my brother's hand-me-downs. I grew up with homemade haircuts by my grandma, you know, just chop and big poof. And so there were times where I thought, oh, we have nothing, and woe is me, and I'm so embarrassed. But we did have these 40 acres, and we didn't have much. So Christmases were sparse, birthdays were sparse, but we had that 40 acres, and that was my friend. And so I spent so much of my life running around, yes, barefoot, get up in the morning, you know, take off in the summers. We often didn't come home till dark. There's fruit trees, there's gardens, there's, you know, you eat what you find. I mean, this was my childhood. So coming back to that was this familiar place that really deeply grounded me and held me. And truly, we were so scared. I cried most of the drive from Washington, D.C. back to here. I was so scared because I sensed, you know, I had a sense of what we would encounter. And I talk about this in the book, but when we first get home, one of the first things I do is kick off my feet, my shoes, and I step into the field behind the house. The soil's just been turned, and I just sink them into that warm soil. And that's the moment when I thought, ah, I'm home, and it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay.
So when you were coming back, were you thinking about the fact that you were going back to this land that you did love and that that was going to be helpful? Or did you kind of discover it after coming back that the land was going to play this role?
I had no idea it was going to play as big of a role as it did. I was so wrapped up in my fear and anxiety about coming home. Is our family going to accept us? Will we have any friends? Are we going to be all alone? But when I got there and was back in the familiarity of that land, I knew this is going to be a sanctuary. This will be a safe place. When everything is, you know, blowing around us, this will be a safe place.
So you make a distinction that I just want to tease out a little bit between the earth and the world. I did have the distinction on here, but I thought better for you to describe it. So you say here, we had put roots down where I had grown up. Thank God we did. Over and over again, it was the ground that saved me, rescued me, and provided promise and comfort through the hardships that lay ahead. The earth saved me from the world. My hope is that by sharing my story, you are inspired to a place of awe and wonder. I hope you'll attune yourself to the wisdom the earth whispers, and my prayer is this compels you to open your heart with greater compassion for the world. So unpack this earth versus world distinction.
Yeah, so throughout the book, I use these two terms, earth and world, and I make the distinction in the introduction that the earth is kind of it's the natural world. It's what is without us meddling in it. And the world is kind of, you know, us and the institutions we've created. It's the communities we create. It can be beautiful, but there's a lot of hardship and horror that also comes from the world. And so, yeah.
I was going to ask, it feels like it, one of the things that I think it does that is good and important is decenters the human.
Yes.
From the earth and world, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And centers, sort of different words people use, right? Creation, mm-hmm. You used in there, nature, the earth, the land. What do you think about that as a part of it, the decentering of humanity?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, and this comes out too in some of the chapters where, especially when I'm observing in the garden. I think that we can learn from nature how we should be in the world. And so, this idea that we aren't up here and the earth is down here It's more of a sense of we're all in community together. Us with the bugs and the butterflies and the soil and the trees, we're all, it should be a reciprocal relationship between all of us, but we've tried to kind of control everything and, you know, bend the earth to our will, if that makes sense.
It does. It does. And it's been extremely damaging, of course. Let's dive into, like, so I've got three stories here for you to pick from. We've got Mabel, Spider, right? We've got Sweetie, the robin, and then we've got the various pollinators and caretakers.
Okay. Let's talk about Mabel.
Okay. And this can help us tease out, like, centering the earth and then what that teaches you, I think, about the world, right? Or that's what you seem to be drawing from. Please.
Yeah. So I talk about Mabel in this. There's a chapter called Mabel. I think it's called Mabel. And growing up, I, despite being outside all the time, I was terrified of spiders. Terrified of spiders. And so I had things, little weapons and things with me to get rid of the spiders. I was terrified of them, like irrationally afraid of these things. Okay, they don't belong in the house, I will say that. But when we moved back here and I was working on the farm alongside my mom, it's a flower farm, we were in the flowers one day and the garden spiders were starting to come out. And if you don't know, these are those big black and yellow. They just look very terrifying. Those big black and yellow spiders. And we were in the zinnias and there was a web with a big garden spider. And I freaked out and I was ready to get rid of it. And my mom, you know, steps in and talks about, isn't that great? You know, a garden spider there is, you know, helping us and taking care of the grasshoppers and so on. And I was like, what? You know? And I started doing some research. I said, well, I got to get to know this garden spider. So I did all this research and found out all of the things that were destructive to the flowers that the spider was taking care of. And I started to realize that this thing I was so afraid of, and by the way, we named the spider Mabel. And every day we watched over it. Once in a while, we'd throw a little bug in there for her. And as I became proximate, as I began to have a relationship with the spider and appreciate it and realize it, I started thinking, gosh, you know, isn't that something, this thing that was my enemy, my nemesis, is actually my collaborator and my friend and being helpful. And so, you know, it was just this reminder that it's really important for us to try and do that with each other as well. When there's someone who we think is our enemy, you don't know, maybe we could be future collaborators or future friends. And so, yeah, there's a bit in there about just Mabel and how Mabel caused me to reflect on my own attitudes towards other people.
I'll quick say this piece here, but when I stopped to get to know Mabel, to call her by name, when I moved in closer, read about her, studied her skills, and learned to appreciate the ways she made my job easier, it changed everything. Her willingness to sacrifice was astounding. She was no monster. She was a saint, and she had things to teach me. The sacrifice was her death comes soon after.
Yeah, so I write also about when she was no longer there, and I was so sad because every day, you know, and get in the garden, talk to Mabel. And she was no longer there. And then I read that these garden spiders, these mother garden spiders, give their whole life to creating babies. And so there was a sack of a whole bunch of babies, and she would never even get to see them. They would hatch in the spring, but her life was over. And just like, wow, that's beautiful. She gave her whole life to these little ones. So.
Okay, what about Sweetie?
Oh, Sweetie.
Tell us that story.
Yeah, this was a sad story. In our garden, we have rooms in our garden, and there was a room that had some tomato cages. I left them against a fence. And in the spring, a robin made her nest on here, on top of the garden cage. I shouldn't have left it there. I'm still kicking myself about it. But I left it there, and the mother made a nest on that, leaning against the fence. And she laid her eggs. And so every day, you know, I'm out there checking, and they're still there. And then they hatched. And then I was watching them grow up from these tiny little things. And they were really close to flying the nest. And one day I was out in the garden working, and I heard the mother robin, who I named Sweetie, she was going crazy. And I went and looked, and her nest had turned over because we had a cat outside. And the cat went and flipped the nest over, and the mother was wailing, and the cat was on the other side of the garden licking his chops, and I was crying. And so I was astonished at how much it bothered me to see these broken little bones and feathers of just a bird on the ground. But then how much more the bones of the children in Palestine, how much more the bones and the flesh of the children at the border, how much more the Ukrainians, how much more the children in the Congo. I mean, just on and on. And it just, again, was this poignant reminder, this is just a bird, and I'm so upset. Am I upset about these others? You know, does that cause me as much grief and sadness?
So it feels like a relationship, this relationship with the natural world, it's opening up compassion,
yeah,
right? Sort of naturally, without you forcing it, being in relationship, caring about these things that we often overlook, is opening you up and teaching you compassion in a way that was new, was different, and was I think this is another word that is important, was, did it, like, embodied,
yeah,
as opposed to just a mental idea,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, should we do the pollinators next?
Sure.
One more? Okay. This is caretakers and pollinators. I have a little quote here. Do you, yeah, want to start with that? I settle into a wicker chair in the corner of my pollinator garden. And we're going to learn about the secret garden that she made. We'll get there in a minute. Basking in the quiet, watching swallowtails and monarchs flutter atop the heads of purple
verbena.
Dozens of allium plants. This is perfect. You should be doing this. Arch around the edge of a walkway that's lined with field stones, stones that had been tilled up by the plow and stacked in piles. There were honeybees as thick as a wool blanket hovering over the
allium,
Monarda, and mountain mint. Hummingbirds move with elegance up and down the honeysuckle vines, dipping their long, slender, forked tongues into the nectar. Random clumps of milkweed rise wildly among the lilies.
Cocosmia, coneflower, salvia, cosmos, yarrow, foxglove, black-eyed Susans, and hyssop.
There we go. So tell us about this. What do you see in this?
Oh, yeah. I mean, so the pollinator garden room is one of my favorites, and I have this chair tucked in the corner. And for me, it is just a really important reminder of the important nature of reciprocal relationships and how we need each other, and everyone, the well-being of everyone is linked to the well-being of everyone else. And it's never as clear as when you're in a pollinator garden and you realize those flowers need the bees. Those bees need the flowers. We need the bees. You know, everything is connected. And so, yeah, there's kind of a chapter that really focuses on that and talks about this, the importance of our connectivity and our care for each other and the well-being of everyone, depending on the well-being of everyone else.
Yeah, there's a natural sense of belonging in the, you know, it's not a forced sense of belonging in, at least in the pollinator garden. It just happens naturally. All right, I'm going to just do a quick thing just for fun. I gave the U.S. a hard time Frederick Douglass rightfully gave the U.S. a hard time, and I agreed with him. Here is something where this is a little win for us, okay?
What does that look like to you?
Mud.
For your first ever bite of Texas barbecue, I think we should try some burnt ends.
Oh my God. That just melted in my mouth.
Yeah.
I can't even explain. It's absolutely sublime.
That's really good.
So it doesn't taste like mud?
No. Wow.
I can't even describe it.
Perfect.
That is so good.
It tastes like steak or smoky.
My eyes are watering. Right.
I've not eaten all day, and it's probably the best thing I've ever eaten.
Wow. What age can you legally move to America?
It's a small win, I realize. A small win, but we're going to take what we can get these days, folks. Yeah. I'm going to play just a quick clip. It's about a minute and a half, 2 minutes. And it just, as I read your book, this came to mind. This was something we covered a couple years ago. There's a woman named Susan Cain. She wrote a book called Quiet about introverts, and another book called Bittersweet, and that was the one we spoke about a couple years ago at Still Processing. And I just want to play a clip of that and then read something from your book, and I think there's a lot of resonance between the two.
I mean, when I first went on this quest to explore bittersweetness, and maybe it's worth kind of defining what it is, it's the recognition that light and dark and joy and sorrow are always going to coexist. And that's what life is. And it's an awareness of passing time, an awareness of the impermanence of life. But it's also a kind of piercing joy at how incredibly gorgeous and beautiful life is. And then it's this, to answer your question. What I've come to believe through this quest that I went on to understand the nature of bittersweetness is we are creatures who are born to transform pain into beauty. That is something we have the ability to do.
Say that again. You gotta say that again.
Okay. We are creatures who are born to transform pain into beauty.
God.
Because one thing is certain, we are all going to experience pain at some point. Probably we all have already, like some kind of profound pain. And there's two things we can do with that. One thing is to not really acknowledge it, and then we end up consciously or unconsciously taking it out on other people through abuse or passive aggression or whatever it is for us. And then the other thing that we can do is accept that pain is part of life too. And what can we do to transform it into something else, into some kind of healing state, maybe for other people who have experienced the same kind of pain that we have, maybe into some kind of creative expression, but somehow to turn it into beauty. And this isn't just me saying this. I really went on this quest for the last 5 years to understand all of this. And there's a 2,000-year tradition of artists and musicians and writers, and all of our wisdom traditions have poets, been grappling. Yeah. All the poets, they've all been trying to tell us this. Like all our stories, all our religions are all telling us the exact same thing. And yet our culture is somehow blind to it.
And then this from your book. The more pain the world brings upon itself, the more I have found myself desperate to cultivate beauty. This need drove me back to the secret garden to expand its walls, to increase this haven of peace as the world raged in recklessness. I could only think to get on my knees and plant seeds that might bring beauty to a world increasingly desperate for it. I added another room for additional vegetable beds, more food, more healthy sustenance, more goodness sprouting from the earth. So it feels like you're doing what Susan Cain is saying is somewhat natural to human beings. If we attune, I don't even know what the if is actually, but for you the if is if you get out into nature, it seems to me.
Yeah. One of the things I discuss a lot is, for me, there is this need to always have one foot in the earth and one foot in the world. The earth restores me. It gives me rest. It gives me hope, like so much hope. It's a beautiful place. but I can't stay there because it would cease to be beautiful if I stayed there because I know what's going on in the world. And so I need to have one foot also in the world, involved in the work, trying to make the world a more wholesome place, a more whole place. But I can't stay just in the world either because then I'm burned out, I'm exhausted, I'm strung up. So I need both. For me, that balance is so important. And, you know, as the world just seems to be spiraling, I say the world, but really the United States, and I guess the implications in the world as well. But I am continually drawn more and more into the garden. And I'm constantly planting and I'm constantly creating. And, you know, we have this, the secret garden, we call it. There are many, many rooms. Oh, do you have, that's the pollinator room. Okay. Yep. Yeah. Sure. What is it? Oh.
So tell us about, so the secret garden happened pretty spontaneously from what the book describes.
Yeah.
Tell us a little about that.
Sure. So there's a couple things. Our house is very small. So a family of six in 900 square feet. It's a very small house. And so one thing was we need outdoor spaces. But the other thing is my daughter Josephine and I were reading The Secret Garden. And so I was like, oh, we can do this. We can create a secret garden. So, you know, I got up during the night and I sketched out a whole plan. And then my dad has these, because he grows flowers, he has all these wholesale catalogs. We went and, you know, I purchased all these shrubs to create the walls. And everyone thought I was crazy because I bought the cheap, the 6-inch tall bare root shrubs. And I mapped this whole thing out, you know, in the yard and stuck these little things in. And everyone is like, what is this? I don't understand what I'm looking at. And I like, I have a plan. Trust me. I have a plan. It's going to be amazing when it all grows, but it might be years. So we created, there's a kind of a living room, there's a fire pit room, there's a dining room, we call that room France. That's the fire pit room. There's a big vegetable garden room, there's a kitchen herb room. So there's all these different rooms, and it just kept getting bigger and bigger after the 2016 election especially, and then when Brian was running for Congress, that was a very painful time for our family as well. And so it just kept growing and growing and growing. And I just felt, it just felt good to be putting seeds in the ground, knowing that something good is going to come up. And that's a guarantee. Something good is going to come up. In the midst of the madness of the world, I knew something was going to come up. And it did. And so, we didn't know at the time it would become a place for family gatherings, a place for parties, a place for campaign events, so we had no idea. A place for people to come and get respite from everything going on, a place for meditation.
And you said you're leading retreats and pilgrimages mm-hmm. to guide people.
Yeah.
There's you have, what is it, a meditation platform. Mm-hmm. Which one is that in? Do I have that one?
Over there, that's the meditation. So in the center, center of the big vegetable garden, I built a little meditation platform because I needed something just to be surrounded by the greenery and the vegetables growing up and the food.
This is a little between.
One of the doorways, yeah.
Okay, nice. So this grew up from
nothing? From those 6-inch, yeah, wow. All of it.
Amazing. Yeah. I'm just going to run through all the pictures I have here.
That's the contemplative treehouse.
A contemplative tree.
It's a great reading spot in the shade.
I believe you. Here's a nice little spot.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask, since we have a little bit more time before we go to Q&A, I want to ask you a little bit about your dad, if that's okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm going to read this and then ask some questions about it. When Dad wasn't working the farm, he often walked around the land in what I imagine was a kind of spiritual fellowship. Life was slow and simple with him. He walked his fields, checking on the growth of various flowers. Dad seemed to know every living thing by name. The birds, fish, trees, plants, anything scurrying about this corner of Eden. Mom and Dad walked the trails in the woods, knowing where the nests of birds and squirrels and the dens of foxes were, and spent evenings at the pond tossing handfuls of fish food to the bluegill bass and catfish and watching muskrats, geese, and ducks. Dad frequently walked his fields under the light of the moon when a whole other group of critters were awake and busy, dashing about before the light of morning came. You also mention, and this is sort of what struck me as I was reading it, you also mentioned that, not surprisingly, he was conservative. Yep. And it just got me thinking about my mom's family grew up, she grew up, and most of them of her family are still in Northwest Iowa, so they have this strong relationship to the land as well. And her childhood was on a farm, and so a lot of similarities there. But a lot of these places don't seem to be, if you will, creating people for whom the land is transforming them into what you've become. Like, I was just struck thinking, there's a gentleness to knowing and caring about land and animals, right? There's a real gentleness. When I was thinking of your father and your mother as well walking around, and I was thinking of other farmers that I've known, like my grandfather, there was always a lot of gentleness in many of them. Obviously not all of them. But those are now bastions of MAGA. Mm-hmm. And I guess what I thought was, why isn't it working in the same way that I think it works on your father, right? You said he was conservative. He's passed, as the book explains. It's a chapter in the book. Yeah. He was conservative, but he did not like what was happening mm-hmm. With the MAGA movement. I don't know. I just wonder about that. What does that stir up for you?
Yeah, I think I'm really lucky. I don't know. I mean, my dad and my parents were very disappointed with what had become of the Republican Party. They would still say they're conservative politically, theologically. They're very conservative. But there was something different about him, and I wonder sometimes if it's because he was not a big farmer. I mean, goodness, his tractors are from the 1940s, you know, these little chuggers, and his old equipment. And he wasn't so much of a businessman as much as that he loved farming. And he was like a kid in a candy store when he pulled out a seed catalog. It was just so exciting. Let's try this, let's try this, let's try this. So he really did have this love of what he was doing and this passion for the land. And, you know, it is interesting because after he passed, my aunt gave me a bunch of letters that he had sent to her and my uncle. And my dad went to Calvin. He studied history. He was a history teacher for 27 years. And in these letters, it's very clear that his love and passion was always plants. Always. He couldn't wait till the school year was over. It was just misery for him. He wanted to get to summer where he could start growing things. When my parents were first married, they turned the guest bedroom into, it was just plants. My dad put boards on the bed, and everything was set with plants, you know, and he would get these exotic plants, and my mom would write in her letters to my aunt and uncle, you know, I would say you can stay here when you come to visit us in Michigan, but there's no room for you in the guest bedroom because all these plants. And so he was a very sensitive guy. I will say that too. And I think that helps. My dad has a very compassionate heart. You know, my dad would cry. A lot of dads don't cry. My dad did. He was just moved by things easily. And so I think, I don't know, he was able to maintain a softness always. So I don't know, you know, and him and I were able to connect despite our differences, when we were working side by side in the field together, we were able to have some really special, really meaningful and deep conversations that I know a lot of my friends have not been able to have with their dads. But somehow that field was this just this space where we both had this passion for growing things. We're working side by side. I see his humanity. He sees mine. You know, and it's okay. And we could have these conversations. And no one's trying to persuade anyone of anything. It's just, well, here's why my views have shifted. You know, okay, now tell me about yours. You know, and so it was just a really, really beautiful, special relationship.
Was it? It sounds like, and I just want to maybe draw this out if it's real, but it sounds like being in the field while you're having these conversations was an important component. Am I getting that right?
I think so. Yeah, I think so.
So I want to finish with this. You grew up here. You left, changed a lot, came back. The reception was mixed, right? Especially during 2020. We talked about that last time when Brian ran for Congress. It was ugly. It was bad. You had to leave the farm for safety a few times. But you've been here, well, now you've been here over 10 years.
Yeah.
Been back for over 10 years. Does it feel more like home? Or is it still uneasy?
Yeah, I think, you know, home, the home ground feels like home. It will feel like home. But I also know that someday my mom is going to pass and that farm is going to change hands and it won't be us and we, you know, it won't be my siblings. So that land is not going to be there forever for me. I won't have access forever. And so what I have come to find out, though, is that home, it's not necessarily just a place. I think home is when you're around people who love you, you feel the love, who love you, no matter what your views are, no matter what your beliefs are. To me, that is home. And, you know, we have our church community. That's a home for me. It's a home. Those are people who love me, who I love, who, you know, it doesn't, I don't know. It just, I think too of last summer, I don't know why, but I was really fascinated with snails and observing snails and, you know, the fact that they carry their home on their back. They carry it with them. And I feel like that. And there's been many places in my life where I've lived or where I've traveled or where I've been, and I thought, this could easily be home for me. I have thought that many times in many different places. Sometimes it's the people, sometimes it's the place. But yeah, so right now this is home, and this feels right, and it feels good.
I'm going to open it up for questions. I might just come around with this one because that other mic was not great. So, does anybody have any questions? I will come to you, Cindy.
Christy, what would you say your motivation or your motivations were for writing this book?
Well, the practical answer is, it was my doctoral project. but even before then, I had kind of been thinking about writing about this coming home. And I know there are a lot of other people, maybe in this room, I know there are a lot of people around here that come here, that move here from other places, or that return here, who have that same situation as me, and just that it's going to be okay, and there are people here who can be your community, and you know. But then the other reason I wrote it, and I do a lot of this. I have a Substack. Some of you subscribe to that. There's so much loud madness in the world. There's so many voices shouting and screaming, and so much anxiety as a result. People are getting very, very scared and worried and frightened. And I want to just lift up little things and say, look, isn't that amazing? Look at this. You know, despite everything going on, these things, these good things are still happening, because I think, you know, clinging to goodness and joy, that's all part of the resistance. It's so easy, and I talk to so many people who are so stressed out and so depressed and so anxious about the state of things right now, and I just think we cannot forget the goodness that is still around us and among us, and I think it's so important, and we need the voices telling us, look over here, this is terrible, and we have to do something, but we also need, I think, voices reminding us of the goodness. And so I feel really passionate about that.
Anyone else? I see you back there. I'll come to you in a sec.
It's kind of more of a comment, but my wife and I are reading some of Buechner right now. And just this afternoon I was reading in a chapter where he makes the point that life is, if anything, about pain. And I just wanted to say that your reflection on this is healing.
Thanks for sharing that, Al.
Because this was part of your doctoral program and you started out with like kind of one vision for what you were going to write, I kind of know the answer to this, but I would love to hear you talk about it more. How did the loss of your dad shift, like bring other things into priority and focus and change your perspective on what you thought was most important to write about and how you shifted, you know, how did that change what you wrote about? And especially with you talking about the transforming pain into beauty, you know, how did that bring about beauty through something that was really devastating? So that's my question.
Thank you. So my dad died halfway through it was a 3-year doctoral program. I was working on this, and it was a surprise, and it was very hard for all of us. And so I ended up writing about that, and I had this plan to write this book, and then I couldn't stop thinking about my dad, and I kept writing about my dad, and I went to my advisors, and I said, I keep writing about my dad, you know, I'm so frustrated, I have to put that away and get back to my project. And eventually they said, can we see what you're writing? What are you writing about your dad? So I shared that, and they said, this is beautiful, this is part of your project. In fact, I think it's the center of your project. So it's literally placed kind of in the center of my book, and everything kind of flows towards and from that. So, yeah. So initially, it was not going to be in there. It was just, I need to write my way through it. And yeah, so frustrated. I got to get to my project, and my dad keeps getting in the way, you know, but then he became a part of it.
Anyone else? Questions, please.
I think about the relationship I've had with my only son, and what has happened as we've evolved through the years. Do you feel as though you have were able to reconcile or to have a free relationship with your dad despite the earlier theological and conservative politically stuff that was going on between you, maybe when you came back or before you came back? Say a little bit more about what really it was like to be with your dad at the end.
Thank you. I guess the thing is, for me, why we had such a beautiful relationship, even when we were on polar opposites, we still maintained a relationship. I think it had to do with proximity. When we lived away and we weren't in the area, it was easier for me to feel terrible things about my dad and my parents because of their views. Like, oh, I can't believe them. But when we were proximate to each other, when I'm living next door to him, and when we're meeting in the fields, when we're bent over planting together or weeding together or harvesting, it changes everything because I see that he's a really great person. He is a wonderful man. He is compassionate. He's doing the best with what he knows and his experiences in the world. And, you know, he's doing what he can. And I believe that is true of most people who have different views than me, even when I'm really angry and upset about those views. When you talk to people and hear, you know, their stories, you often just, I don't know, like a level of compassion comes up. And I will go somewhere a little dangerous maybe with this, but I've just shared this with a couple people recently, but whenever I see Donald Trump on the television, I feel compassion. I'm really angry about what he's doing. He has no business, in my view, being in any kind of leadership position whatsoever. But when I see him, I see a wounded child. I see someone who is never loved, who is never enough. I see someone desperate for affirmation. So I feel this weird compassion. It keeps coming up. And I'm like, what is that? I don't know what that is. But I feel that despite that I oppose almost everything that comes out of his mouth and everything that he signs with a pen. So I don't know. You know, I feel that for him. My dad was nothing like him, but I still felt that compassion and love and relationship with him. So,
anybody else? I was listening to a podcast the other day, and this political commentator, Sarah Longwell, for The Bulwark. Check it out if you're interested. They're great. She was saying something very similar. She said, it was great. I did save it. Maybe I'll use it at some point. But she was saying, like, we're being led by these extremely broken men. She's like, Zuckerberg created Facebook because he didn't have any friends. He wanted a girlfriend. He's still that guy. Elon Musk, I mean, these are very, very broken men, including, of course, Donald Trump. And it is hard to know what to do with that, yeah. Right? Because there is a compassion that is appropriate, right? But in the face of such, you know, I think of Frederick Douglass's words, right? We need the whirlwind. I mean, he's like, we need the hard stuff. We need the scary stuff to confront this. So I do find myself sort of torn between the whirlwind and the whatever the gentle thing is, the gentle stream.
Yeah, and again, like, someone like that, like, just to be clear, I think has no business being in the kind of position he's in. But it doesn't take away that, like, underlying compassion that keeps nagging me. That I don't know what it's about exactly, but yeah.
It's good. It's a good thing to keep alive. I don't think there's any doubt about that. Anybody else? Any questions? I'm just going to put up this patriarchy thing. I think this is a huge freaking problem. When we look at these broken men, it's this, you guys. It's patriarchy. I promise. Read Bell Hooks. Let's get every man to read Bell Hooks' book on patriarchy. Anybody else?
Right there.
Oh, sorry.
I can't help but think about your first book that you wrote. I don't know if it was your first book, The Cracked Pot or something like that. And I just wondered about the relationship of that to what you've written now. Already your family, your parents must have known that you were having a breaking away.
Oh, yes.
Long, long ago.
Yeah.
And how does that affect today and what you wrote?
Yeah. Thanks for bringing that up.
Because that was 2012?
2012, yeah.
Early adopter of deconstruction.
Yes, essentially my story of deconstruction. And yeah, the funny thing is when that book came out, I was so scared for anyone to know the truth of my story, I shoved the box of books under the bed and didn't tell anyone about it for a long time. But that book is actually this week having a second edition. So that book is coming back now, Cracking the Pot. And that is my story of deconstruction. And so that is the story of, you know, breaking everything down, all my belief systems, and kind of slowly rebuilding it, which is a lifelong process. I'll never be done with that. But yeah, so that's kind of the story. That's sort of the story before this story. It's the story of why it was so hard to come back and why it was so terrifying. And in part because that book was out, so everyone knew, you know, anyone who wanted to know could know this is what she really thinks. You know, so it was, yeah, I felt like putting a target on my back when I came home. So, yeah.
Anyone else? Please.
I very much appreciate having grown up at a farm myself. But I kind of, so what's the sense? I mean, this was a flower farm.
Mm-hmm.
So what's your sense of growing flowers as opposed to a different commodity, corn or soybeans or milk or beef, where the land is used in a different way and the product is different? I don't know how to phrase the sentence quite, but what's your sense of the fact that this was a farm that produced beauty have to do with your sense of nature as beauty and coming home and that sort of thing?
Hmm. Yeah, okay, that's a good question. Well, yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, when you're growing flowers, everyone is happy around, you know, you're always, people come and buy flowers or you're at the farmer's market selling flowers, and like, it's always a joyful thing. It's always a joyful thing. The flowers in the fields is just, you know, a ray of color. It's so beautiful. And so to be surrounded by that all the time. Now, before we had the flowers, we had just a few beef cattle for beef for ourselves. And we had a couple milk cows growing up. So, you know, we milked the cows for our cheese and our milk and all of that. And we had goats for a while. My parents did Angora goats. And that was for the wool, obviously. But my dad just kept coming back to plants because he loved growing things and he liked growing unusual things. And it started out with just a gladiola farm that he bought from someone, bought the business. And then he started getting the catalogs in the mail. And then he just started expanding and expanding and expanding. And then he retired early from teaching because that was so stressful, and he was just able to do the thing that he loved. But yeah, I mean, I think also my dad's joy for that was contagious. He was so excited about that work, you know, and his kids worked alongside of him. His grandkids worked alongside of him. I mean, it was a happy place, a hard place sometimes, of course. But yeah, to be surrounded by color and beauty doesn't hurt. And the acreage, the 40 acres, is really special, I think. It's just beautiful kind of rolling hills and ponds, and part of it is wooded with trails, and there's a lot of trees, and it's a lovely place. So,
anyone else? Oh, there we go. Common.
This one might be tough. Why won't you stay on the farm after your mom passes?
Because no one in my family can afford it. You know, land is expensive. I have my youngest brother is going to try, I think, to stay there. And that's a complicated story. But yeah, he still lives with my mom, and we'll see if we can work that out. But yeah. Yeah. But I see that. I see that down the road, that it won't be with me forever. So
anyone else? Thanks.
I keep thinking about you leaving the farm and how sad that seems. And I'm wondering, what other ways do you touch the earth? And how will you touch the earth at that point? Or even now? Are there other places?
Yeah. I mean, so we live in the house that my grandparents, well, it's okay. My grandparents grew up in the farmhouse. And when they got older, they built this house on the corner of the farm, the little one. That's what we live in now. And then I grew up in the farmhouse. And I think I am always going to have my hands in the dirt. Like, absolutely. It's sort of maybe it's an addiction. I don't know. My family might say it's an addiction. But no matter where I am, I'll be planting, I'll be creating beauty. And part of why I planted the secret garden and began to create that as kind of a long-term project for myself is knowing I won't have access to those 40 acres forever, but we have our 1 acre. What can I do with that? So, yeah.
Anyone else? Christy? Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
So I'm Marlon. I'm Josh's dad. I just want to draw your attention to what's coming because we build one on another. Christy is, and we hope you'll come back for these events. Ann Cansfield is a star. I mean, you will love her. She's married. She has a wife. She has a couple of kids. Her dad, the story of her dad, and what her and Josh will talk about is brilliant stuff. Dr. Camden Morgante wrote a book called Recovering from Purity Culture. And she's a deconstructionist, and will connect with some of the things you heard tonight. And then the star of this year is Dr. Anita Sanchez. And the reason I wanted to come up is to draw the parallels and the connections between Native American spirituality and the connection to the land and Dr. Anita Sanchez. She is brilliant. She's older, but she is a climate change advocate, goes all over the world. So please mark your calendar, take one of these when you leave, and come back and experience what we're trying to do here.
Thanks, everybody. Appreciate you all.